Hi, welcome to another Writers After Dark. I'm your host, Summer Brooks. And remember, we're here because good stories start with the writers, since wherever there's a story, someone's either making it up or writing it down. And today's guest is New York Times bestselling thriller paranormal author Tosca Lee. And we're here to chat about her latest book, The Line Between, which came out back at the end of January, if I remember correctly. And it is a apocalyptic thriller, which you don't usually see. It's either the before or the after. And right here, we're on the edge of everything falling apart. And that's always an intriguing place to start a story. Welcome, Tosca.
Thank you so much for having me.
So The Line Between is more, it's a medical apocalyptic thriller where people are racing against the clock to decipher what the reemergence of this particular, shall we say, end of the world virus means. Mm-hmm. Correct?
Right, exactly. Yep. And it's, as you said, it happens right as the, you know, event has begun. And so it's not before or after, it's right, you know, going right into the thick of it. So
where did the idea come from to start right at the edge of the destruction?
You know, I don't know that it was actually a kind of conscious decision. It was just this idea. Well, let me back up a little bit. I had seen this headline about this disease emerging from the permafrost. This happened in Siberia a couple of years ago. It was a reindeer carcass, and it was filled full of anthrax. And so when it thawed, it actually made an entire village sick, and a young boy died. And so I saw this headline and remembered thinking, wow, I didn't really kind of know that was possible. And then started reading a lot of related articles about how scientists were nervous about what could be, you know, basically lurking in the melting permafrost. And so I think by the time that I sat down to write it, it was, okay, I want to show, you know, the early onset of this, what becomes a pandemic. And I wanted to show how it creeps across the U.S. and how life can go from normal to, wow, did you hear about this weird thing going on, to, oh my gosh, it's getting bigger and now we're scared, and, you know, then it just goes out of control. So I kind of wanted to show the progression. So I don't always plan where I'm going to start in a sequence of events when it comes to, you know, the story. I kind of want to always jump in at what seems like the most interesting place.
So tell us a little bit about your protagonist. Winter Roth is... I'm trying to describe her without going into like spoilers. She's sort of an outcast from a doomsday preppers group.
Yep. Well, she's an outcast from a doomsday cult. So she's been part of this religious community, self-contained religious community in the middle of Iowa, so on the American prairie, for the last 15 years of her life. She's 22 now, and she's just getting expelled for, you know, reasons that are learned later on throughout the book. So at the beginning of the book, she's getting expelled and pushed out into the wider outside world, which she has been taught to regard as evil. And she's trying to start over. And she's, you know, she remembers life in the outside world as a very young child, but of course, so much has changed. And of course, the most recent change is that now there's a pandemic starting and moving all the way across the U.S. So Winter herself, she's 22. The character is named after my stepdaughter. Her name is Winter. She is very plucky. She's, for as much as she's been quite sheltered living in this doomsday cult, she's also very resourceful. She's very smart. And occasionally funny, though I don't think she really means to be. So,
well, you
so
have
that.
Well, you have a penchant for creating headstrong, strong, willful, idealistic female leads, and just, to me, making her background be one of a group of people who prided themselves on isolationism because of their beliefs. Having her be the hero sets up a lot of, shall we say, hurdles in her way, because she has to learn how to work with other people again in order to fix what's broke.
Yeah. She has to learn how to work with people. She has to learn to trust people. And she's got some, trust issues that make a lot of sense at the beginning of the book. And so there's that as well. There's technology that she doesn't quite understand because she's been in a place that doesn't use certain technologies that we use today, like cell phones, smartphones, things like that. She doesn't know how to drive a car. She has to learn how to do a lot of things that you and I might take for granted.
Did that make it easier to push her along in the story? Did it make it harder? Was there a particular challenge in that you wanted to explore?
I'd say, yeah. I mean, it was harder for her, I would say, than for me. So, you know, it is a bigger hurdle for her. Later in the book, she's on this mad race across the Midwest, and she is not very skilled at driving a car. She's had to learn how to do these things. So these things are a lot scarier and harder for her than they might be for someone like you or I. But at the same time, the thing that made it so fun is being able to kind of look around at the world with a set of different eyes. Because, you know, for instance, you and I are used to walking into a store and seeing, you know, 12 different kinds of canned peas, for instance. But for her, you know, Winter, who has been diligently growing and canning peas in this cult for years and years and years, when she walks into the grocery store and sees, like, you know, all these varieties of different kinds of canned peas, you know, some with this, some with that, and here over here on sale for 88 cents, it's mind blowing. And so I think it's, for me, it was really about looking around at the world, and not just the stuff on our grocery store shelves, but the stuff, you know, on our TVs and the people we call celebrities, and, you know, some of whom are really ridiculous. And seeing that with, you know, fresh eyes going, you know, yeah, what? Basically. So.
Yeah, I could imagine the shell shock of coming from an isolated community and seeing your first issue of the National Enquirer.
Right, right. Or the first episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians or something like that, where you're like,
oh, dear.
Yeah, pretty much. So.
So your foil, I guess, for Winter is Chase Miller. Now, explain a little bit about what he's really after.
Well, there's a little bit more that we learn about Chase in the second book, which is coming out in September. It's called A Single Light. Mm-hmm. But as far as in this first book, Chase is a guy who, you know, he's kind of in transition. He's a former Marine, and he has become, you know, he did for a while become an MMA fighter, and then he trained other fighters for a while, but he's kind of in this limbo when he enters the story. And then when things are really coming down and getting very bad, he and Winter intersect, and he enters the story. But I think in a lot of ways, you know, even though he's very worldly, he knows how to do all these things. He's got all these great skills that might be considered very helpful in an apocalypse, like fighting or knowing how to shoot or, you know, all this other stuff. And then you've got Winter over here. You know, they have this similarity in that they're both trying to find themselves and figure out, what does life look like for me now that, you know, this past identity has been left behind, basically. So they're both trying to reenter, you know, secular and civilian life, you know, and find their place.
And setting them up for this, I guess, trying to uncover the deeper meaning behind this emerging threat, The actual disease is, to me, unique because it creates a, I'm going to say, a great mental disability, an Alzheimer's-like mm-hmm. condition in a large number of people who come in contact with it. And it's different. You don't have people actually physically dying. You have people losing themselves and dying in a different way.
Right. They are essentially developing dementia, which is exactly, so this is a prion kind of disease in the book. And the best known prion disease is mad cow disease. Mm-hmm. There's a human variant of that called Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. And basically you get these holes in your brain and it's a slow death. It's always fatal. And it's very tragic, actually. And so this particular disease in the book is a rapid form of that. So it doesn't linger for years, but up until the point that the person who has it dies, they are going insane. And then they are a danger to themselves and other people, of course, too.
So what was the attraction for choosing something so insidious and implacable?
Well, prion diseases are real. They are very frightening, just as they are. As I mentioned, they are always fatal. You can't test for them right now, even though they are trying to create tests for them. But right now, the main way to test for a prion disease is to look at the brain tissue of someone who's passed away. And then you can say, ah, yes, there it is, but they're already dead. So, and there's no cure. The other very scary thing about it is that normal sterilization techniques in hospital operating rooms don't get rid of prions. And so, you know, it's the scary disease to begin with. It's kind of the opposite, too, of being a zombie. And here's why. I mean, because we've got a lot of zombie stuff. And, you know, I'm a big fan of zombie stuff. I'm a big fan of The Walking Dead and all that. But in this case, you know, the best known way to get something like mad cow is to eat meat that's been contaminated with spinal or brain tissue. So it's not that you're a zombie and you eat brains, it's that you eat the brains or something like that, and it causes this disease. And in fact, there are people in the book who have come in contact with animal, you know, brains of some of the first animal carriers, and that's part of how they became infected and the disease progressed. So why this one? Well, just probably because it's very scary just on its own.
How much research did you have to dig into to find exactly the type of affliction you were looking for? And how far down that rabbit hole did you go?
That's a really good question. I love doing research. That's something that I've been known for in my historical novels in the past. In this case, I kind of had an advantage because I have a sister who is not only a physician, but she teaches medical school. So
wow.
I was like, okay, look, I need something that's kind of like this, but I really wanted it to be something that could feasibly begin out of something that came up out of that melting permafrost that I was so fascinated by. And so, you know, after a lot of talking and after she had done some thinking, you know, and this is kind of where we ended up with this kind of, I'd call it custom boutique pandemic, more or less. But, you know, based on that's something that's plausible still. So I didn't want it to be something completely, you know, outrageous and, you know, far beyond the boundary of what could be possible. So.
Okay, and you mentioned earlier that the sequel, A Single Light, will be coming out in August?
Yes. Oh, sorry, September.
September.
17th. Yep, A Single Light comes out on the 17th of September, which is not that far away. I've actually turned in the final proof pages, and so it is getting ready to get printed right now.
Okay. Without going into any spoiler territory, is that the conclusion of the story or are there more beyond?
So that one right now is the conclusion. And I had only planned for two books. So just a book and its sequel, which I like. I like that format. I've done that before. with the two thrillers I had before The Line Between, which were The Progeny and Firstborn. And, you know, if at some point down the road there's some reason to have a third one, I would completely be open to that. But as of right now, I'm really happy with the way it all concluded in book two.
Any hints for people what they can look forward to in book two?
Sure. So book two will be the continuing adventures of Winter and Chase. And there's a brand new character in book two that I introduce who has quickly become one of my favorite all-time characters I've ever written.
Wow.
And so I'm really excited for this book. Yeah, I've written a lot of characters because I think A Line Between, I want to say that's like going to be my 11th novel, published novel. So, you know, in the casts of all these books, when you add up how many people are in each book, to say that, I really like this character a lot. So I can't wait to introduce this character to everybody.
Nice. Now, in addition to The Line Between and Simple Light and or Single Light and Progeny and Firstborn, those have been optioned for television and film, correct?
Yep, that's right, for TV, yep. So that's exciting.
Can you shed a little light on that? Can you tell us what's going on with those?
So with The Progeny and Firstborn, CBS has come on to help produce. And the thing about doing anything movie or TV-wise is, you know, there's always this series of hoops to jump through. And so it's definitely not a straight road or a very simple process. In the case of The Progeny and Firstborn, that's been 4 years in the making. So when we let the announcement out, it seems like it's something that happened overnight. But in reality, it's taken a very long time. It's kind of like writing a book. You know, when your first book comes out, everybody's like, wow, your book's out. And if it, you know, you become a bestseller, it's like, wow, this is an overnight sensation thing. No, it's not. You know, it took years and years to get to that place usually. So same is true with TV. And so with the single, with the Line Between, that one is entering the development process, which means that the producers, in this case, it's Radar Pictures and Ed Burns's group, are in the process of attaching people to that. So, you know, and then after that, it continues to move forward and then they start looking for networks and that kind of thing. So lots of steps that have to kind of happen.
Well, technically it could be considered that The Line Between was an overnight thing because the book just came out in January.
That's true. And actually it did enter TV development before it came out. And that's due to the fact that the producers of that are the same ones that are producing The Progeny and Firstborn. So, I've already been working with this group. And so when I wrote The Line Between, they were like, hey, can we look at that? And I was like, sure. So, yeah.
That's nice. Like the producers you're already working with go, oh, she's got something new. Hey, can we have first dibs, please?
She's got more. Let us read that one.
Nice.
And we have a really great working relationship. They're wonderful people. I regard them as friends. And so, it's fun.
Nice. So this is truly very early in the process for both properties. And there's no sort of deadlines, casting, production in play yet.
Not right now. The Progeny is much farther down the road in the process. But not to the casting point, whereas The Line Between is still just getting started right now. So,
cool.
Lots to do.
So other than having just turned in a Single Light, what else is on your mind to write?
What's on my mind? Oh, how long do we have? It's a big laundry list of stuff. I'm in the process right now of putting together several new ideas and firming up a few new proposals that we're going to take out and see if we can find a home for. So there's about three really cool ideas that I'm really excited to go take out and see what the response is, and if we can find a home for those, then I'll start writing, and that'll be the next one, or two or three, or whatever. So, yeah. We're about my agent's out of the country right now, and he'll be back in just a few days. So as soon as he's back, then we're going to hit the ground running. We'll be busy.
Awesome. So what is, for you, the spark, the first attraction to, okay, this is the story I want to tell next, and how do you prepare yourself for going into that space?
That's a great question. I love that question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that before. So the spark is when an idea comes along. And, you know, lots of ideas come along. I mean, ideas come every single day, right? But some of them don't go away. And they just kind of bug you and poke at you a little bit. And so those are the ones that I kind of know, you know, maybe this is something really worth thinking about. Also, the ideas that I'm kind of scared of, you know, and I think, I don't know if I could pull that off. If I'm a little scared, that's usually a little, you know, telltale sign that maybe that's a good one to pursue as well. Also, when I keep a file of ideas. And so when I go in and I start typing out these ideas into files and trying to kind of flesh out a few extra words so that I don't just have a line that when I come back to it later, I don't know what it means. If I go in and I start fleshing out a few extra sentences and I find myself adding and coming up with more and filling stuff in that is coming to me on the spot, then I think, okay, this is obviously something my brain finds entertaining. Maybe somebody else would find this entertaining too. So, okay, so that's the spark part. And how do I prepare myself? I think that part is, it's always research. It's always looking into, even if it's something contemporary, just researching different aspects of the story and learning a little more to help fill in those blanks and kind of get those wheels turning as I prepare to look out towards making an outline.
Now, you mentioned the idea scaring you being a little bit afraid of it, and that being sort of a flag that maybe that's the one you need to chase down. What do you do to tell yourself to not be afraid of it, to get past that point where you go, oh crap, and actually just work on it?
Yeah, that's another great question. And you know, when I go and I speak, I teach at conferences, and I teach about writing, speak about writing. I find that fear is one of the biggest topics that I find myself talking about and that I find writers asking about and often needing tools to deal with. And the answer, the short answer is that fear doesn't always really go away. I trick myself into getting past it by telling myself, I'm going to just write the story. And as far as I know right now, no one will ever read this. And the reason I say that to myself is because it takes the pressure off. Granted, if the story is under contract, I know at some point it's going to be read. But for that moment, it is true. No one will ever read this as of right now. And they're not going to read that first draft as it is. So that's kind of how I get past that. And I think there's a little bit of an adrenaline rush too, when you're willing to say, okay, I'm scared, but because of that, I'm going to have to dig in that much harder.
So what is it you teach the writers you talk to about facing that particular fear?
Well, the first thing is, you know, just shedding this idea of imaginary others looking over your shoulder. So
yeah,
because it happens. We sit down and we think, what will my teachers think of this? What will my parents think of this? What will my shrink think of this? You know, whoever it is, whatever readers, you know, and what happens is it affects your writing, and it affects your writing voice and your authenticity and everything. So that's my number one rule of writing, is write like no one will ever read this. And my second rule is just get the clay on the wheel, because there's too many times that we try to make it perfect as we're going. And what happens is oftentimes writers don't finish the book. And the only way you can finish is you have to be willing to let it be a real big mess for a while. And I'm not comfortable with that either, and I don't like it. But there it is, and you have to be okay with that, and you can come clean it up and fix it later. But if you continue to fix it as you're going and try to redo the beginning over and over, you'll never finish. So I talk about that. I talk about, you know, just getting done and tools to move past that. But that is, I think, one of the biggest hurdles, not just for writers, but for artists or people who have done things like music or other endeavors in the past and then put them aside for a while, whether it's for careers or kids or whatever, and then have wanted to come back. And then they're scared, even though there's no pressure, even though there's no art gallery saying, give us 10 pieces or, you know, anything like that. There's just this kind of, what if it's not good, kind of fear. So that's something that I really enjoy helping other writers with.
Do you think that that particular blob of anxiety gets smaller the more projects you start?
Possibly. And I think it helps when you see a project through to fruition. Because when you do that, you look back and it's the exact same way that you gain self-esteem in certain areas, and you gain self-esteem by doing hard things. So when you've seen it through, you can look back and say, okay, I lived, right? And I did it. And I'm really exhausted right now, and I don't know if I ever want to do this again. But guess what? A few days later, you might be like, I think I've got a great idea to do another one. But, and you know it's possible because you've already done it once. So I think, yeah, it could be because of that. But I also think that as you progress throughout your career, if you're fortunate enough to have some level of success, the fear can actually get worse because now you've got these expectations that you either imagine that your readers have of you or that you have of yourself. And then, you know, because you're on a roll, you're now afraid to not do as well as the last book or to in some way not live up to whatever it is. And so it can also be something that is difficult even throughout a successful career.
Cool. So tell everyone where they can find you and your books.
You can find my books anywhere books are sold, basically. All the usual suspects, you know, your Barnes & Nobles and Amazons and indie bookstores and any bookstore. And my website is toscalee.com. And all the social media stuff is there. And I'm on a lot of them. So you can jump off from there and follow me and see our big giant puppy on Instagram and all this other crazy stuff and on Facebook and Instagram and all that. So,
which one is your most active for writing and sharing writing advice and writing tips?
So the most active for that would be my writing newsletter. I have two newsletters, and they can both be signed up for on my website.
Cool.
And so I've got a regular one, and then if you sign up for that, you also have the option to sign up for my newsletter. It's called From the Asylum, and it's just for writers, and that's my regular advice. And also it contains interviews with authors and editors and all kinds of people like that as well.
And if I'm correct, you are about to embark on a book tour to promote The Line Between.
Mm-hmm. I am. And I've got a busy year ahead of me because what we did is, you know, instead of taking 2 weeks like the traditional tour and just cramming it all together, we've kind of spaced it all out throughout the rest of the year, which makes it a lot more manageable. So that calendar is on my website as well at toscalee.com. There's a calendar tab, and I'm adding new places all the time. So if there's not a place near you and you want to come see me, just check back because there's new ones going up.
Okay. So. And you need to live tweet from some of your events just for the hell of it.
I do. I do need to. And I forget. Sometimes I go to these events and I'm like, I forgot to take pictures. I forget, you know, it's like, I can only do so many things, but I'm really trying to get better at it. So,
well, Tosca, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. I truly appreciate it.
And The Line Between is in bookstores now. You can also go to her website and read the first three chapters if you want to get a taste for the story you're diving into. And you can also keep an eye out on her book tour. Keep tabs on when she may be coming to a city near you. And as she said, she'll be updating that throughout the rest of the year. And yes, that includes Thriller Fest in New York City in July, where maybe you'll see me too. Haven't decided yet. It's still up in the air. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to call in to Writers After Dark at 602-635-6976 or send me an email here, summer@writersafterdark.com. If you have a question or a suggestion and you want it, we can read it on the show here on the air and get some conversations going. You can listen to Writers After Dark through iTunes, through Stitcher, through Google Play, and Player FM. And you can also leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Please let people know that you are enjoying this show and maybe they should check it out for themselves. You can follow us on Twitter. That's Write After Dark, W-R-I-T-E, After Dark. And, of course, the website, writersafterdark.com. You can check out other interviews that we've done, other podcast episodes, and, of course, reviews of books, audiobooks, graphic novels, and more. I'd like to thank everyone who's helping support this conglomeration of entertainment geekdom here at Writers After Dark and over at Slice of Sci-Fi and Babylon Podcast and a few other places as well. All of your donations help keep these little corners of the internet online. And if you'd like to help, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. And if you're not inclined at this moment to do a monthly pledge, you can do a one-time donation every now and then through PayPal using paypal.me/scifisummer. I'd like to also thank Shadon and Sybin Quest for providing the theme music here. If you like what you hear, you can follow the links on the website to other songs, other musical compositions that they have done. I don't think you'd be disappointed because they have a lot of selections that I found entertaining. This one caught my ear in particular. But that will also do it for this episode. See you next time. And remember, keep looking for your own stories.